Please call the case.
Case number SCAP-12-789, Asako Beef Procurement Policy Board. Arguing for the appellant and cross-appellee, Marissa Lemming. Also appearing for the appellant and cross-appellee, Patricia O'Hara. Arguing for the appellee and cross-appellant, John McLaren. Also appearing for the appellee and cross-appellant, Arthur Park. Arguing on the merits.
Good morning to our counsel on both sides. Are you both ready to proceed? And my understanding is that the state will be, state AG will be proceeding first. So, Ms. Lemming, you'll be proceeding with your argument first. You've saved 10 minutes for rebuttal. Is that correct? And on behalf of Mr. Asato and Mr. McLaren, you've asked for a five-minute warning in your argument. Okay, very well. Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices. May it please the Court. Deputy Solicitor General Marissa Lemming appearing on behalf of the Procurement Policy Board of the State of Hawaii. Now, there are very many issues presented in both the appeal and the cross-appeal, but this morning I would like to focus on the two issues that I think are dispositive of this case. That is Mr. Asato's lack of standing and the validity of the rule. Because I think that if the Court finds or it decides either of these issues in the state's favor, then there is no need to reach the rest of the issues presented in Mr. Asato's cross-appeal. And after briefly after discussing Mr. Asato's lack of standing and the validity of the rule, I would like to briefly touch on how sovereign immunity precludes an award of attorney's fees in this case. Because Asato lacks a legally cognizable injury, he does not have standing. A plaintiff who lacks standing is not entitled to invoke the jurisdiction of the court, and this court should order this case dismissed.
Haven't our cases said that in the area of government bids, that there seems to be a presumption that there will be an injury to the taxpayer, simply because the award of a government contract would result in an expenditure of funds? So hasn't this court pretty much decided that presumption should usually apply?
I don't believe that's true post-procurement code. The last case that decided that ruled that there was a presumption of injury based on an invalid bidding procedure was Federal Electric. I believe that's the case you're referring to. And that was decided before the procurement code was enacted. And in that case, the court had decided that the bidding procedures used were inherently defective. And there's
Saying that the procurement code prohibits taxpayer suits?
Yes.
Where in the procurement code does it say taxpayer suits are prohibited?
Well, it doesn't state that explicitly, but the remedies in the procurement code are exclusive remedies.
Can you think of any government action that generally would be precluded from a taxpayer suit? Sorry, that was way too broad. That would involve expenditure of government funds.
Well, I don't think the court needs to answer that question in this case because Mr. Asato has not even alleged or proven that he has had any pecuniary injury.
His point, however, is that pecuniary injury is presumed. Well, what's your response to that?
My response is that injury is not presumed in this case. This case is distinguishable from Federal Electric because there's no allegation that the bidding procedures used were inherently defective. And that in Federal Electric, bidders were asked to respond to different specifications in their request for proposals. And There's no allegation that happened in this case. There should be no presumption of injury here.
What about the Iuli case? Is it, how does it, or do you view it as the controlling law in this area, or is there, are there other decisions that we, I think there's a debate between the two parties as to where we should look for controlling law. What's your position with regard to Iuli and the view that it may not address the kind of situation we have here?
Well, I think that the Iuli v. Fossey test is the proper test to apply here. In Iuli, they made clear that the earlier Hawaii cases that had indicated that it was unnecessary for the plaintiff to prove damage to himself were further clarified in the hundred or so years since they had been decided. And in Iuli, they said that the requisites for taxpayer standing had been further delineated since those cases were decided. And now, a mere irregularity without more, not amounting to fraud, was insufficient to justify intervention by the taxpayer. The case specifies that three requirements must be fulfilled before taxpayer standing can be granted. So you need an illegal act that impairs the public interest or works public injury, and you need specific facts to prove this element. Here it's speculative that the rule actually injures anyone. There's no facts in the record to prove that the rule or the use of the rule has injured anyone and that it hasn't, in fact, resulted in a benefit to taxpayers. The rule is designed to further the public interest by increasing efficiency.
The procurement code governs the relationship among bidders and the government, right, or the purchasing agency.
Yes.
It doesn't say anything about taxpayer suits, does it?
Right, that's why taxpayers aren't, the remedies.
Taxpayers aren't even involved in the procurement process.
Right.
Right.
And they're not, by design, they are not supposed to be allowed to protest particular contracts because the code.
Where does it say that?
Well, the code in 704, it says that the remedies provided for in the code are exclusive.
But wouldn't that be exclusive for the people covered by the code?
Yes. However,
so the code only sets out the procedures for the people who are have bid and are disgruntled about the outcome, or people who are performing government contracts and have disputes with respect to the contract as with the government, right?
But the legislature specifically limited the participants who could participate in an aggrievement protest because they. They wanted a streamlined, efficient method of awarding government contracts.
So are you saying that no taxpayer could ever challenge an expenditure of government funds if the allegation is, and we're only at that stage, that the award of the contract violated the law?
I'm not saying that a taxpayer could never bring a suit. I'm saying that Mr. Asato did not properly allege taxpayer standing. He did not prove the elements required for taxpayer standing, and this court cannot presume injury.
Did he satisfy any of the three elements, in your view?
In my view, no.
So what if he does allege that, you know, he is a taxpayer that is paying the extra GET, the GET for a while.
He would have to prove that any loss in, or any pecuniary injury to him was a direct result of the board's use of the rule.
So if he came in with a declaration of a number of contractors who said we would have come forward but for the fact that we understood that this process was being run in a way that made it very unlikely any interest we expressed would be recognized or rewarded with the contract, and they said had we come in, we would have done the job for 50% less. If he had made that showing, would he be able to proceed?
I think he probably would have been able to proceed if he had properly alleged the facts and proven them. Since this case proceeded to summary judgment and the plaintiff bears the burden of proof in proving each element of standing, he would have had to do more than just state factual allegation, which he didn't even do in this case. All he said was that he was injured by the board's use of the rule. That's a legal conclusion. That's
what do you think the legislature, why do you think the legislature required a minimum of three bidders on a government contract?
I can't speculate as to why the legislature, I mean, I'm assuming that it's...
So if we don't know, assuming you don't know, then we should take the statute at face value, right? The statute says three.
It does say
three. It doesn't say less than three. It doesn't say more than three if you can. It says a minimum of three,
I guess. It does say a minimum of three. However, the legislature wrote into the procurement code 102B4L, which exempts any goods or services from the requirements of the procurement code. And that is what the rule, that's where the rule gets its authority from.
But that's, by the way, the rule itself doesn't cite that section as its authority, correct?
It cites its authority as 202, which is the general powers to make rules. It does refer to 304G in its implementation citation, but our view is that it is authorized by B4L and by the board's general powers to make rules consistent with the procurement code.
Both sources of authority sustain the rule?
Yes. And this court should defer to the agency's interpretation of the statutes that govern it, because the agency does have expertise. It's been interpreting
We have just as much expertise in interpreting statutes, don't we?
Oh, yes, of course.
So if the legislature had says three minimum, and you adopt a rule that says less than three, is there a conflict between the two?
Well, there's not a conflict because the statutes are overlapping. So what happens is...
We're not talking two statutes. We're talking one statute and one rule, right?
Well, 102B4L and 304G are what I'm saying are overlapping.
Go ahead.
What happens is when an agency needs to procure a professional services contract, they first go through 304G, and if the selection committee is unable to recommend three qualified persons for a particular job, then the rule comes into play. And the truth of the matter is that not every professional who submits his statement of qualification and expression of interest is going to be available for every job, is going to be interested in every job, is going to be, you know, willing to accept the fee range.
And you think that didn't occur to the legislature when it drafted?
Well, I think it did. That's why they wrote B4L. They allowed for flexibility and common sense in implementing the code.
Let me just ask you, for B4L,
yes,
did the the head of the administrator for the procurement code ever make a finding based on B4L with respect to the contracts that plaintiffs have focused on?
Well, I can't say whether or not they did because it's not in the record. And those contracts, we don't really know anything about those. If you're talking about those 26 pages of exhibits that were at the end of the record, they're or at the end of the...
So you're asserting that B4L applies, but you don't have any evidence that the administrator applied B4L by making a written statement that B4L applies to this contract. Isn't that one of the requirements under B4L that the administrator has to make a written decision that we're going outside of the bidding procedures because it's not practical or advantageous to...
I'm assuming that the chief procurement officer of each of those branches did make that kind of determination. But it didn't even have to be pursuant to the rule because under B4L, the chief procurement officer can make a written determination for each individual circumstance. They don't have to use the rule.
Doesn't that highlight a little I think an aspect of the statute, which is that B4L appears in a long list of items under 4, which are actual things or services. So, you know, expert witnesses, works of art, goods and services for commercial resale, opponents for athletic contests. And there is a rule where the procurement office has added additional items of goods and services to that list by rule. What's different about the rule we're talking about here, though, rather than being specific to particular goods or services, it's more of a process-oriented rule.
Right.
So isn't there an argument that B4L envisions exemptions for particular items in particular circumstances? It does not envision an exemption for an entire type of situation or factual situation or procurement situation, a glitch in the process as opposed to a particular item. And what would your response be to that?
Well, a professional service is a type of goods or services that that can be exempt from the requirements of the code under B4L. And it's true that the rest of them are categories, but our view is that
there's actually a rule of statutory construction that you would look at all of those
right.
other items, and the inference would be the legislature intended the power here to be of the same kind or quality. So it would be envisioned that the legislature was expecting the board or authorizing the board only to exempt particular categories of goods and services as opposed to exempting an entire procedural aspect of the process.
Yeah.
What would your answer be to that?
Our answer is that if the board is allowed to exempt entire categories of contracts from the requirements of the procurement code, it should also be allowed to exempt it from a smaller procedure within the procurement process.
Isn't the opposite true? I mean, if you're exempting a whole category, there's less likelihood of abuse because you're saying all contracts in that particular area. What you're suggesting is that as to specific circumstances, which is where the danger lies.
Well, it is case by case. That's I think that's where the safeguard actually comes in because in order to use the rule, there has to be a finding that the prices are fair and reasonable, and there has to be a finding that either there was adequate time for other bidders to submit their statements of qualification, or there's inadequate time to resolicit through public notice. So I think that these are additional safeguards that help ensure that the procurement is conducted in an ethical manner. And ethics are written into the procurement code.
Well, assuming the procurement code has nothing to do with taxpayer actions, which I think is probably, but just in my opinion, the reasonable inference. The Chief Justice was saying that if you look at the list of items that precede L4, that you would construe goods and services as used in L4 as being the same type of services that are specifically listed prior to that general provision. You agree with that?
Isn't that a fundamental principle of statutory construction? Well, what is it, birds of a feather flock together? Or
yes,
something?
Well, I would say that professional services contracts would fit into those categories.
Why would it fit?
Attorneys' services are listed under services of expert witnesses. It's A.
Well, statute itself makes a distinction between the term services and the term professional services, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. But I would argue that professional services would be covered under the term services, the more general term services.
Then why have two definitions? If L refers to goods and services, the statute defines services as the furnishing of labor, time, or effort by a contractor not involving a specific end product other than reports which are merely incidental to the required performance. As opposed to that, it defines professional services as services within the scope of practice of architecture, landscape architecture, professional engineering, etc. So if for the fact that professional services are not included in the L4 or 4L provision mean that was not intended to include professional services, but rather services as defined in the statute.
I think that's an incorrect reading of the statute, and I think that professional services are types of services, and they fit into the definition that you just read. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal if the court doesn't mind.
Very well.
Thank you.
Mr. McLaren, your argument.
It pleases the court. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today on behalf of Mr. Asanto. Rather than sticking with my prepared remarks, I want to address some of the questions that have been raised on the opening argument. The procurement code deals with people who are asking for government work and contracts. What we are here arguing about is a procedural rule on how contractors are selected. This rule pertains solely to professional services, and in fact it pertains to design professional services, architects, engineers, landscape surveyors, and so on. Why? The reason is clear. For those of us who have been in Hawaii for the last 20, 30 years, we understand what has happened in campaign contributions, pay-to-play, and government contracts. Mayor Fossey was very famous for saying he rewards his friends and punishes his enemies.
Mr. McLaren, you know, the state argues that there are situations where you can't get three design professionals. What about that situation?
Name one instance where that happened, you know, where they offered solicitation. There are hundreds of architects and engineers in Hawaii and on the mainland who love government work. There is not a single instance reported in the newspapers, in the case law, saying, you know, too bad, we're short. We have to choose this one entity.
I thought there were some examples cited where there were only two. In fact, those are the ones that had formed the basis of your concern.
What Justice Acoba's question was, mm-hmm. were there entities where they couldn't find a short list of three? The examples we cited, in our mind, were deliberate violations. They were selections based on the rule. They knew they had a short list of less than three. They could have gone out and solicited more. In the PB America's InfraConsult situation, PB America's was selected as the managing contractor for the rail. the article that's in the record from Sean Howe documents that there were two bidders, Burger Group, I believe, and PB Americas, and Melvin Kaku, the Director of Transportation Services at the time, in response to a question by the selection committee member, Lori Stone, when she asked, why, you know, do we have only two? This is a huge contract. He said, never mind. Choose. The contract solicitation was only open for 1 month, according to the newspaper article. It was published once in the newspaper and once on the website of the city.
Isn't that a different claim? That's a claim that the process was followed improperly as opposed to the process was invalid.
They used, and this is documented in Leslie Tanaka's auditor's report, they used this rule, 3-1-22-66, to make the selection. It's clear. It's, you know, Tanaka says this over and over again. This is the report that was cited in the complaint, cited in our briefs. It's publicly available on the website. You can read it. The unfortunate thing for Mr. Tanaka is he missed the fact that the rule was in violation of 103D 304G. It never occurred to him.
I guess my question is, if the rule was used improperly, if the allegation is two people came in, but they could have easily gone out and gotten four or five or six, that's a suggestion that the rule was improperly applied as opposed to the rule was invalid, which is a different claim and not one that I understood was pleaded.
The claim is that the rule is invalid. It is in violation of the statute, has been in violation of the statute since June 95 when the statute was changed. And though the drafting process of this...
Why wouldn't it be reasonable for the administrator or the board, because they have the power given them by the legislature to adopt rules to try to take care of a situation where you would not be able to obtain three design professionals?
If they were granted that authority by the legislature, but they weren't. Beginning in 1995, the legislature essentially told PPB no less than three. And they made that abundantly clear in the 2003 amendments. The reason for this is to distribute...
Prior to that, the statute had allowed them to select less than three.
No. You know, it's a little bit unclear, but you'd have to go through portions of the act that are copied in the Record on Appeal. In 1995, the legislature amended, just find this to be accurate, they amended the statute, they deleted the phrase, unless fewer than three submissions have been received. This is Act 178 in 1995, and this is I cited this in my briefs. But the legislature kept in the following section, the head of the purchasing agency shall evaluate the summary of qualifications for each of three persons provided by the screening committee. So deleting a less than fewer than three and leaving in each of the three persons provided in 1995 established the three persons, no less than three persons doctrine.
So there was an intentional act by the legislature to take away, I guess, the discretion to proceed when there were less than three in favor of a requirement or a mandate that there must be three.
Yes, absolutely. And the background is to, you know, as
why did the legislature choose three?
You know, I don't know the rationale. It's not clear in the legislative history because our committee reports are often quite vague. There's no floor statements. My understanding is...
I guess my question, too, is, does it matter?
Well, the reason for three is to give architects and engineers who want to do business with the government agencies a fair opportunity to have their credentials presented and be considered. You know, three is probably an arbitrary number. It could have been five. If you look at the procurement website,
could you look at the number three as being the legislature's determination that that is the minimum number that the legislature or the government should consider in order to maintain competitive bids that would be cost efficient and therefore benefit the public interest.
Sorry, that came out twisted, but
the whole purpose of competitive bidding is to make sure that government gets the best deal, right? The best and most responsible bidder.
Yes.
Well, and so isn't it the legislature's judgment to set the floor for the setting in which that interest should be met? And if they choose three, then it's three. It's not less than three. It's not some other number. The legislature's made the determination. It has to be three.
Yes, they did make the determination. Just a point of correction. Architects, engineers, and other design professionals do not bid on jobs. The only way they can get work is under 103D 304. They're exclusively required to use, you know, the procurement officers to use that system. And the underlying reason.
I use bidding in the general
yes,
sense.
Yes, I understand. I just wanted to.
Seeking proposals then from these
yes,
people.
And what it really amounts to is when these architects and engineers submit their qualifications every year, they have some reasonable assurance that somebody, Company X, is not going to be cherry-picked, and that somehow two other entities, at least, will be in the pool of, for the selection committee, and then the highest-ranked entity would be picked after that. So there's some fairness to that process.
What if there aren't? What if there are fewer than three? Does government just grind to a halt at that point?
Well, it never has, and it frankly never will. I'm not being, you know, smart about this. You know, what instance have we as the public ever heard of a government agency not being able to find architect and engineering and, you know, landscape surveying services because there's a shortage?
But that's essentially a factual question, though.
Yes.
Is that a factual question we can even answer on the record we have now?
You can't answer it on the record, but by experience, it's never happened. But the solution is, if you have a short list of less than three, to go out and re-advertise. If it's an emergency contract, there's an emergency statute in place where you can do that. So if we get a hurricane in Iki, they can get emergency architects and engineer services.
So the fact that the legislature considered an emergency situation and set the number at three would indicate that they took into consideration contingencies where, for example, you couldn't get three.
Yes. In our statute.
But they set the number at three, and unless it was an emergency, you have to have three.
Yeah, and then they can, you know, under the emergency provisions, that, you know, do what's necessary.
But if there's not three, you just don't build. You don't build the bridge. You don't fix the leak.
No, you go out and
keep trying, keep trying, keep trying. Well, what if you don't get three?
Well, in truth, there always has been, you know, for good jobs, three. Some of the attachments we have in the complaint are not architect and engineer services. They just happen to be, you know, the short list of less than.
Is it our concern that three would not be enough? I mean, it is our role as a judiciary vis-a-vis the legislature. If the legislature has said three, is it our role to say, well, in certain situations you probably won't have three, and therefore this rule, even though it, and we're just stating my position or my opinion, flies in the face of the statute, should be upheld?
The rule shouldn't be upheld. It's black letter law that the rule can't.
Well, there are alternatives, right? One is you can go back to the legislature.
Yes, absolutely.
Second, it's difficult for me to believe that people with the expertise of the administrator and the skill and intellect of the engineers and architects that they couldn't find some way to either redefine the scope of work or to parcel out parts of the project to people who would be qualified to do it. I mean, isn't that a way you get these projects done?
Yes.
You redefine the scope of the work?
Yes, yes.
Or you parcel out the contracts, right? I mean, you divide up the contract.
Well, what my understanding of what happens is if a ranked person is contacted by the procurement officer, they then get into the details of the project and their cost estimates and so on are being done. And that's the point at which you said... You
in know, fact, in these proposals that engineers and architects submit, they're the ones who define the details of the work,
yes,
aren't they?
Yes.
It's not the government, because the government doesn't have the basic expertise. It sets out the goal, and it sends it out to the experts. And the experts are the ones who define the details, and they also are the ones who, in effect, bid on the project.
Well, there is a dollar value that the procurement officer is looking for, but quite often, because of the realities of the project, it, you know, the actual cost may be much higher, in which case the procurement officer would go to the first ranked person and say, look, you know, this is a little bit higher than what we thought. Can you do X, Y, Z to, as you said, redefine the project, parcel out some of the things to get it under budget? So that's exactly what happens in the real world.
Can you address the taxpayer argument on standing?
Yes. During the research for the this appeal, I happened on the Council versus Capena and Lucas versus American Hawaii Engineering cases. These were not briefed and argued down below. But what I saw was, first in Capena, the very first taxpayer standing issue that was raised. Now, it was a mandamus action before this court, in which the court said, you know, you need to do an injunctive action. But the principle of, you know, taxpayer being able to sue the government for an unlawful act that the government was committed was cemented in Capena. And it was carried forward in Lucas, which is the first government procurement challenge by a taxpayer. Lucas is very similar to Federal Electric versus Fosse in that the plaintiff, Lucas, was also a disgruntled bidder. But the court recognized under Capena that he had standing as a taxpayer to challenge the claims. You know, the getting to the point of whether or not the procurement code precludes taxpayer lawsuits.
Well, what about Ely? How do you analyze the Ely factors?
Glad you asked. I have. I've looked at Ely very, very thoroughly. Let me flip to my analysis so I can be accurate about this. Ely cited to Lucas and preserved this taxpayer standing doctrine at the end of its decision. It said, for cases involving the propriety of bidding procedures, and that's the heart of this case, the court said the Federal Electric case involved a plaintiff who sued alternatively as a taxpayer and as an unsuccessful bidder on a city contract to upgrade the police department's communication system. In granting standing based on plaintiff's taxpayer status, we recognize the obvious resulting injury to taxpayers where the bidding procedures used were found to be patently improper and defective. The deleterious consequences to taxpayers flowing from such a method could be presumed. That is the Lucas Capena doctrine there.
But doesn't Ely say the plaintiff has to show a loss in revenues resulting in an increase in plaintiff's tax burdens or to taxpayers in general?
Yes, it does say that.
Because otherwise, anyone could come in and challenge any government action that they, in their opinion, thought was illegal and that they thought had or alleged had a pecuniary effect. Isn't that right? Any claim. Anyone who had any claim that the government had spent money in a manner that they thought was unlawful would be able to bring an action, correct?
That's That's correct.
And is our doctrine that expansive? Doesn't Yulee limit it to require at least an allegation of a loss of revenue or an increase in tax burden?
I don't think so. Yulee is, you know, with all due respect to Chief Justice Richardson, I think is very oddly and awkwardly worded. And in my view, it's really an outcome determinative type of decision.
Well, Yulee actually affirmed Federal Electric,
yes,
and Lucas, didn't it?
Yes.
Because from what you read, it said that after setting out some of the three-part tests, that if the bidding procedures were found to be patently improper and defective, and I guess that's your allegation here because of the three-person problem, deleterious consequences to taxpayers flowing from such a method, here selecting people not from a list of three but less than three, could be presumed.
Yes.
So it didn't overrule that presumption, at least within the bidding process. Because if we talk about taxpayer suits, you can file taxpayer suits in a lot of different things. But here we're focusing in on the bidding process, which directly, I guess, is injury is presumed because it directly affects taxpayers. If you're going to expend public money for projects or whatever, then you're going to affect the taxpayer, right?
Yes.
But wasn't Yulee decided at a time prior to the existence of the procurement code and all the other cases you've talked
about? Of course it was.
So at that time, there really was no means for a disappointed bidder to challenge under the procurement code, certainly, so that really the court had to expand taxpayer standing to provide a disappointed bidder with the ability to have some remedy. Is that a possible reading of these cases?
I'm not sure. I'm not an expert in the prior procurement code 103, but we had a procurement code, and we've had one for about 100 years. So
its remedy.
103D is the current code from 93, and it is part of the American Bar Association model procurement code adopted by the legislature, recommended by Marion Higa in 92. So we did have a procurement code in effect. And let me answer it this way, because in Yulee, the court cited to the city charter provision, which had an exigency provision in it. Yulee was all about the HRT bus strike that started in January of 1971. The Teamsters went out on strike. Mayor Fossey came in, bought some buses, created another mess, MTL, and the strike caused a lot of chaos with commuters for 2 months until the Teamsters went back to work. Teamsters, a couple of them, one of them, Yulee, filed a lawsuit saying that this agreement they had with MTL was illegal. The court cited to the city charter provision that has an exigency provision to exempt itself from public advertising of bids. The statute at the time, also cited by the court, 103.22 is the section, didn't have any exigency provision in it, nor did any other provision in 103 at the time, Chapter 103. So this was an ultra-virus act by the city to go out and buy the buses and have arrangements.
Let me ask you also, we talk about the procurement code, and the law does change, but in terms of the principle that taxpayers can sue if there is a injury to the taxpayers because of bidding procedures that are improper, that's a principle that runs across the older bidding statute and the present procurement statute.
Absolutely.
Is that correct?
It's a doctrine that's followed all across the country.
And in Yulee, at least, this court went out and said whether a contract for operating and maintaining a public bus system even falls within the statutory requirements for public bidding. So, in effect, in Iuli, the court expressed an opinion that this contract maybe didn't even fall within the area of public bidding, after confirming that if there, you could presume from, a bidding procedure that was defective, that there would be injury to taxpayers.
In fact, I think the way I read this paragraph in Iuli is this was an emergency. This was a public emergency. And, let the city go buy the buses and create a new bus system because the, people had to get to work. It disregards the statute. It disregards, fundamental principles, but the outcome was a good one in the sense that we got a bus system, people got to work, the strike was over.
In fact, Iuli confirmed, right, that because it's confirmed the right to challenge these contracts, because it said, in granting standing based on plaintiff's taxpayer status, referring to Federal Electric, we recognize the obvious resulting injury to taxpayers where bidding procedures used were found to be patently improper and defective. The deleterious consequences to taxpayers flowing from such a method could be presumed.
Yes.
So in effect, reconfirmed that you could presume injury to the taxpayers.
Yes.
Is that correct?
But was that not, in an era where the remedies for disappointed bidders were substantially different from what they are under the current law and less protective or less effective?
Yes, except, in the Iuli, these were not disappointed bidders per se. These were Teamsters bus drivers. So it's a bit different.
Is there anything when the new procurement code was adopted that addressed eliminating taxpayer suits? Is there anything in the history?
There's absolutely nothing about that. The biggest or the broadest social policy is in the preamble to the enabling legislation, which has been cited in several times in Communication Specific and in at least one other case, and we've cited it in our complaint in the pleadings. Again, the procurement code was designed to handle contracts and bidders, and that's whole process of procurement. It was never intended to preclude average citizens from asking questions about illegal acts from the government.
Mr. McLaren, doesn't Mr. Asaldo have to actually allege that he had suffered some kind of pecuniary loss?
Not under Castle versus Capena and Lucas versus American Mining Engineering.
So do you think that he doesn't actually have to prove an injury in fact under Bremner?
He has an injury in fact under Bush v. Watson and under Roberts versus Midkiff.
Just by status, he doesn't have to actually allege it?
How would he even prove it? Subject to Rule 11, how would anybody in this circumstance
come in, as I said before, come in with declarations from a bidder who said, I was discouraged from participating in this process?
I can't think of a single architect or engineer doing business with the government who would be willing to say that in writing.
The fact that it's difficult doesn't mean that it should affect what the rule is. And, one could debate whether that's true or not, I suppose, but there are times when people are, unhappy enough or dissatisfied enough that they do come forward. But why should that fact affect the underlying prudential requirement of alleging an actual injury and proving it?
Well,
does the complaint have any allegation of your client of taxpayers' tax burden being increased due to this rule?
We did not allege taxpayer burden increase because we can't prove that. What we can say is that contracts issued under this rule have already been let, will never have the opportunity to go back in time, have competitive bidding or solicitations, and see which contract is cheaper and which would benefit. It's an impossibility, and it's an absurdity to require that in this situation. The idea is start with the law first, do things lawfully, and everything's fine after that under the code.
That's why the law says that you presume injury, doesn't
yes.
it? I
yes.
mean, that's
absolutely.
That's what our law says, that because it's a taxpayer issue and the bidding procedures were somehow defective, then, as Iuli says, the deleterious consequences to taxpayers flowing from such a method could be presumed.
Yes, it's impossible to prove in the classic sense pecuniary loss.
And in the absence of a taxpayer suit, there would be no party that would enforce these rules
yes.
or these requirements.
Yes.
But didn't in Hawaii Thousand Friends, didn't we say there had to be a pecuniary loss, which are presumed in cases of fraud? There is no allegation of fraud here, is there?
Yeah, and Hawaii Thousand Friends is not a procurement rule case.
But what about as a matter of jurisprudence or in terms of applying appropriate standing principles? It was a taxpayer standing case, though, right?
Hawaii Thousand Friends didn't go into the issue of whether or not Hawaii Thousand Friends was actually a taxpayer. Every time it bought something, it was a taxpayer. Now, whether Martin Wolf was intelligent enough to argue that is another matter, but in fact, Thousand Friends was a taxpayer if they just paid GET, if they paid rent that had property taxes attached to that, for the River Street office. So I think this is overbroad in this situation. You cannot prove something that doesn't exist. You would want Mr. Osato to start at the beginning of the procurement process, sit down with a procurement officer, go through the negotiations with the ranked bidder, and then go monitor and audit the contract to see if it's over costs or under costs. That's ridiculous.
Let me ask you something. Does it even matter whether or not there's economic injury in the sense that perhaps the economic injury isn't the actual extra cost, but maybe it's the quality of the work?
Well, the actual injury is the violation of the statute.
No, that's what I'm saying. In other words, requiring a taxpayer to show economic loss when there may not be economic loss in dollars and cents, but it may in sense be how good the work was done.
Well,
because you didn't have three bidders.
Yeah, it's broader than that. A violation of law injures all of us. We rely in good faith on the procurement process and our public officials to do this properly according to the law. We are not here supervising the procurement process. And if the city auditors miss the fact that this rule never had statutory authority, what does Joe Public understand about procurement? They trust us. It's our responsibility as the judiciary system to make sure that fairness, equity, and following the law is always part of the procurement process. And that is starting from Kapena.
What do we do? You keep on saying it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. Suppose it does happen, they get less than three. They put it out to bid, they don't get any more. They put it out to bid again. And to be honest, I've been in situations like that. You put an RFP out, you don't get more than three. Do we, as the Chief Justice said, do we just not proceed on the project that we deem is important?
If it's an emergency project,
not an emergency. It's not an emergency, but it's a project. What do we do then?
The legislature opens next month. I'm not being snippy about this, but they have never looked at eliminating or modifying this less than three. So if the judiciary has problems, certainly the legislature, the government operations committees need to hear that.
Well, the judiciary can do a lot of things, but it's not empowered to do everything. Is that correct?
Yes.
So in this particular case, if the legislature has taken out, as you said, in 1995, the provision that you could award with less than three, and affirm that, in fact, you do need three, then that's the law, and it's our obligation to follow that law. The consequences are really for the legislature to determine if, in fact, there is a problem.
Yes.
Because we can't do everything, and we don't have the power to do everything. And I think if the legislature amended the law so that it said you must have three, then that's the law we have to follow. And the consequences don't reside only with what we can do or have to do, but also with the legislature, because we are three branches.
Yes.
And the legislature has said three. It's considered the option of less than three, rejected that option, and confirmed that you need three.
Yes.
And I think unless we arrogate to ourselves more than what should be within the judicial power, I think we have to follow that law.
Again, Your Honor, the statute 103D304 only requires design professionals to be selected under that system. Every other service, every other professional service, non-design service, lawyers, accountants, can be selected by other means, all other means available under the statute for non-emergency procurement. So there are solutions. Now, Justice Nakayama, I don't know the circumstances of your, you know, particular procurement issues, but if they were not design professional services, you don't have to go through 103 or 104. You can choose to do so. That's a great idea. That's the public policy to say, we're spreading the work out among the community, and we're soliciting high and low for everything. But you don't have to. And you know, the whole notion of the limitation to design professionals, again, is to eliminate what
should we arrogate to ourselves the discretion to, in effect, reverse the legislature, where the legislature at one point had said, you can do less, you can go ahead with less than three, and then rescinded that and confirmed that you needed three, for us to come in and now say, after the legislature has done that, you can do it with less than three?
No, the public policy is set by the legislature, and it's there for a reason. And it's explained in the preamble to the 93 Act. It's to distribute the work evenly among the professionals.
Mr. McLaren, if there is standing and if the rule violates the statute, do you, in terms of the remedies you seek, you seem to be seeking an injunction and a declaration of void ab initio.
Yes.
Are you saying that 103D 707(1) would not apply? That's the statute that says if after an award it is determined that an award is in violation of law, then the person awarded, and if the person awarded the contract and has not acted fraudulently or in bad faith, the contract may be ratified and affirmed.
Yeah,
are you saying that this section would not apply?
The section should not apply. It's obviously up to this court to make that determination. I personally think that section of the procurement code is absurd. It basically says, you messed up, you did everything short of, you know, going to jail, but we like the job and we're just going to ratify the contract. That doesn't make any sense. Now, the real issue, for void ab initio of it, whatever contracts are issued under the rule, is they're just void. They're simply void. Other jurisdictions have done that. What happens afterward, as a practical matter, every government contractor has to identify the government agency for errors and omissions, including the government agency's errors and omissions. So where's the problem? You know, everything goes on as it was. This court can say, you shouldn't be doing this. This is a violation of the statute. Everything's void ab initio, and start over again. There's no problem.
If they're in the middle of the project, there's no problem?
No.
If they're 1 week from being done?
No. Let them, you know, they're excuse the term, they're grown-ups. They can figure it out. They can, if this court issues a ruling saying, you know, if you have a contract that was issued unlawfully, they can do something. They can go meet with a procurement officer. They can negotiate terms. Everything else has been laid out in the contract. All the warranties, all the performance bonds, everything has been done. So they, what are they going to do? Now, as Justice McKenna said, they can, if the court allows, use the statute to disregard the violation and let the contract, you know, run its course.
Well, there are many alternatives, but that's not what's facing us now.
Yes.
Right? So that if that question ever arises, then there would be different considerations.
Yes.
Before the court.
Yes.
Including equitable ones. Right?
Yes.
But that's not before the court at this point.
Very well, Mr. McLaren. Anything further? No further questions? Thank you very much, then, for your argument. And we'll hear now in rebuttal from Ms. Lunig.
The first thing I wanted to talk about was the 304G. So in 1995, when unless three, fewer than three have been submitted, language was taken out of the procurement code, that same year, under that same act, Act 187 in 1995, that same language that's in B4L now was added into the procurement code. So even though that unless fewer than three submissions have been, language was taken out of the code that same year, language was added into the code, and the rule was enacted 6 months later.
So what do you make of that?
What was added?
The B4L language that says,
Mr. McLaren argues the deletion of the fewer than three language reflected an intent to preclude the adoption of a rule of the type we're talking about here. What's your response to that?
Well, that language in B4L is a very broad language. It says any goods or services, at the time it just said goods or services including ... which the Procurement Policy Board determines by rules or the Chief Procurement Officer.
But that language doesn't say anything about less than three.
It doesn't, but it authorizes the board to make rules exempting contracts from the requirements of the procurement code.
Categories of contracts.
Well, it says any goods or services under the statute. But
then we get back to the definition of goods and, services and professional services, which the statute makes a distinction on, right? And so if the legislature meant in L to say services and professional services, it could have done that.
It could have done that, but there's no need to do that because it used the broader category.
You mean, you're telling me that
services.
Sorry. So you're telling me that you have a separate definition for services and you have a separate definition for professional services, and they obviously are different. Those definitions are different. But when you use the term services, you incorporate the term professional services?
Yes.
Then why have two definitions?
Because professional services are narrower and they are governed by a separate section.
So how are we to know which applies? If services incorporates professional services, what reason would there be for setting out a different category of professional services and defining it differently from the term services?
Well, because in the code, professional services contracts can only be procured under certain sections. So that's the reason for that definition. But I think we need to step back and look at Mr. Asato's standing. Why are we here in the first place?
Well, Mr. McLaren argues that under the Iuli case, damage is in effect or pecuniary loss is presumed. What is your response to that argument?
There's no presumption of damages here. There's no allegation that the bidding procedures used were inherently defective. like they were in Federal Electric. And Mr. McLaren says they can't prove taxpayer standing. They don't have an injury in fact, so they can't satisfy the Bush versus Watson test. This is purely an academic endeavor.
So you're saying that if the government makes an illegal award of a government contract using public monies to pay for that, and the government goes along with it, and the contractor goes along with it, the public has no remedy?
Well, that's not what I'm saying, but in this case,
what would the public's remedy be if the taxpayer didn't have the right to file suit?
Well,
what would the public's remedy be?
I'm not saying that a taxpayer never has a right to file suit. We have no quarrel with taxpayer standing as a concept.
Now I'm talking about this case. What would the remedy be if no one could challenge this? Government agreed, government's fine with the contractor. The contractor agrees, the contractor gets paid. It's an illegal contract, but the two parties to it are fine with the illegality. They don't care.
Are you talking about
this case? Yes, I am talking about.
But there's no facts to prove that there has been any injury to anyone.
Not following the law an injury? And isn't there a presumption of injury?
There is no presumption of injury in this case.
Why not?
Because it's different than Federal Electric, and Federal Electric was a pre-procurement code case where injury could be presumed based on patently defective bidding procedures. There's no allegation that that's the case here.
And why does it matter that it was a pre-procurement code case
in
Federal
Electric?
Well, the
procurement code provides exclusive remedies for the issuance of contracts. And this is a declaratory relief proceeding. This is a 91-7 declaratory judgment action on the validity of a rule.
Is taxpayer ever mentioned in the procurement code?
Taxpayers are not mentioned in the procurement code, but...
What about the prior law, 103? Was taxpayer mentioned in 103?
I don't know.
But yet, this court has recognized taxpayer suits under the old bidding law, even though taxpayers are not mentioned in the bidding statute?
Well, the problem here is that any remedy that the court issues won't provide redress to Mr. Osato because he has no injury for the court to remedy.
When was the agency rule adopted?
December of 1995.
So the same year that the law was changed,
yes,
they did.
The law went into effect July 1st, 1995.
So the agency kind of just said, oh, we don't like what the legislature did, and they kind of provided exceptions, is that?
Well, no, the board issued this rule pursuant to the authority granted to it under 102B4. The language allowed it to exempt any goods or services from the requirements of the procurement code. And under 91-7, the plaintiff, he cannot challenge particular contracts that were made pursuant to the rule. This is very clear from Buena Vista. 91-7 does not give the circuit court jurisdiction to hear challenges to the application of a rule. And again, the remedies provided for in the code are exclusive remedies. Not even an aggrieved party under the statute could bring a 91-7 deck action to challenge particular contracts that were made. In the compact case, which we mentioned in our reply brief at page 11, the plaintiff was barred from bringing a lawsuit seeking tort damages for an injury suffered from alleged violations of the procurement code because the court said, sorry, the remedies are exclusive. They're in the procurement code. That's the exclusive method to challenge particular contracts. And the decision of the board is final and conclusive unless administrative proceedings are commenced, and then there can be just judicial review. But there are strict time deadlines to challenge contracts under the code. Mr. Sajo is not an agreed participant. He cannot challenge particular contracts using this method.
Does the code mention taxpayer?
No, it doesn't.
So it doesn't apply to taxpayers?
Well, he cannot challenge particular contracts under the code using 91.7, even if he had taxpayer standing, which he does not. The rule,
further, so if we accept that logic, then, you know, Mr. McLaren was saying that I guess there's at least one contract that it was a major contract with a 1 month window. And I'm just wondering then, basically, no one could ever challenge, we could just have a series of less than three bid contracts for these types of professional services.
Well,
no one could ever challenge it?
People who were participants in the procurement process could challenge it, but no one has.
What about a taxpayer who came forward with evidence that there were bidders discouraged from participating and the cost was thereby affected?
If there was a proper lawsuit brought that had facts and not just speculative.
Well, Mr. Asato, if Mr. Asato had come in with declarations that said he's communicated with various design professionals who said they would have participated in this process and bid a better price, but for the fact that they felt the process was one that was improper or not being run in a fair manner, so they chose not to participate. If he came in and said, had people who said, I would have bid and I would have charged 50% less, would that be enough? Or not?
So perhaps he would have
enough or not? Yes or no? I'm
facts.
Sorry.
Yes.
I need a yes or no.
He would have standing under those facts if he had properly alleged pecuniary loss and injury, but he still wouldn't be able to challenge particular contracts under the procurement code. No.
But he could challenge the rule, but not particular procurements. Is
that's
that what
correct.
You're saying?
Yes.
Any further questions at this time? Thank you very much to counsel for both of our parties. The court will take this matter under advisement.